this problem that women over 30 face. Or we could extend that and say the greatest problem that people under 30 face, and women and men over 30, takes in just about everybody. I used to think there are only two kinds of people, those who put toothpaste on the toothbrush and then wet it, and those who would wet the toothbrush and then put the toothpaste on. Then I discovered people who don't brush their teeth at all. But there isn't any loophole in this under 30 and over 30. It takes in just about everybody I know. Well, now, this will be disadvantageous for some of you who have not been with us, or have not read the book, or both. But we'll proceed as if you had, and there is a kind of, we could almost say, circularity here. At least those of you who have read the book or have been with us will recognize this. That is, as we've seen, the first portion of this work, The Sickness Unto Death by Anticlimacus, is a very hard, black walnut-like, compact condensation. And then the remaining portion is an elaboration of this, and there's a constant return to the encapsulation, as well as a constant return to certain categories and concepts. The sickness unto death is despair. And this writer maintains that despair is a sickness of the self, a sickness of the spirit. Spirit is self. And the presupposition, the two presuppositions in this work are, one, the genuineness of freedom. We've spent a little time on that. A radicality of freedom, rarely found in other considerations of freedom. Most considerations of freedom are in terms of economics and social patterns and so on, and even if it gets down into the metaphysical question of freedom, that question gets fouled upon the rocks of the relationship of man's freedom to God's omnipotence, the ultimate. We may have opportunity to come back to that. But this is one presupposition, the genuineness of human freedom. The second is that man has a nature, and that nature is not simply an analytical description of what an individual human being is, but it is a teleological or purposive nature. That is, that man is intended for something. The nature of man is to become something, then, so that he both is that nature and he is to become that which he essentially is. Or, to use very simple jargon, one is to become in actuality what he is essentially or potentially. I don't know if that's the same child we used last time, is it? This child the essence of that child is to become a self, is to become spirit. In that sense, this is the nature of the child, but the child has not become that which it essentially is. So the whole thing here is cast in the category of becoming in actuality what one is essentially or is intended to be. That child is not intended by essence or by nature to become a stick or a lump or a stone. The child is to become an authentic individual, a genuine human being. Now, the negative aspect of this presupposition is, therefore, that one is not born a self. In fact, one may go through life, one may become 30 without becoming a self. That one may, in this huge process of individual change, go through the metamorphosis of birth, adolescence, young adulthood, full adulthood, second childhood, decay, death, without ever having become a self. So you see, the concept of the self here is a rather lofty concept. One is intended to become a self. One may not become a self. Despair is a sickness of the self, or at some levels of the becoming self. If man did not have this nature, or if this were not the nature of man to become spirit, to become a self, one could not despair. Therefore, the corollary of this is that a stick does not despair. A stick is what it is. Even North Dakota wheat seed that doesn't get rain, or if it gets too much rain and never becomes wheat, just rots in the ground or lies dry in the ground or is eaten by the birds. The assumption here is that wheat seed does not despair. It simply is what it is, even though it too has a kind of teleology and is to become something. But consciousness is involved in despair, but there may be despair without consciousness of despair. There may be just ordinary consciousness. Well, now, last time we came to the portion here entitled The Forms of Despair, or the forms of this sickness which one cannot die from. That's one of the great, that's the great misery of despair, that one doesn't die from despair as one may die from terminal cancer. There's an end to it. I mean, it kills you. But this doesn't kill you, you see. One is in it. And that's the living death which despair is. Now this is viewed, these forms of the sickness are viewed here. How many have the book along? Nobody? Pardon? All right, well, I'll mention the pages so you know where we are. And there were some here who said they had the book elsewhere, and you may be interested in the pages too. Now, selfhood is possible, or put it this way, the methodology of this work, I think you could say, is a phenomenological, observational, general statement, and that is the fact of despair, the widespread fact of human despair in these many forms. The next part of the method is then to raise the question, how is despair possible? What is there about being human that makes despair possible, which is not possible for an ashtray or a cigar, even in the heat of the burning? It does not despair. It's because man is a composite, he maintains. Man is a complex being. He's a synthesis. And the child here is born a synthesis. A synthesis of body-soul. This is a dualism, or duality, rather. A synthesis of the infinite and the finite, the synthesis of freedom and necessity, a synthesis of possibility and necessity. So at this, in this portion that we touched on and we'll move from now, despair is looked upon from these angles, you see, of the synthesis. Despair viewed under the aspects of finitude, infinitude, we touched on last time. When we come to the portion before us today, despair viewed under the aspects of possibility, necessity, those of you who are here will find that it sounds about the same, because finitude is necessity, infinitude is possibility. Well, now let's look at this. The despair, or it should be translated, possibility's despair, is due to the lack of necessity. Let's see if there's some portion here that would bear reading for us. Well, we could take this portion on page 168. For the purpose of becoming, now notice this sums up really what I've been saying and is summing up so far. For the purpose of becoming, and it is the task of the self freely to become itself. Possibility and necessity are equally essential. Just as infinitude and finitude both belong to the self, so also do possibility and necessity. A self which has no possibility is in despair. So in turn is the self which has no necessity. And the first part here touches on possibility's despair, which is due to the lack of necessity. Now it may be that this will sound to you as if this portion belongs to youth, and that the next portion belongs to those over 30, or women over 30 at least. This picks up again the crucial role of imagination in becoming a self. Imagination is a very crucial mode of treating personal actuality and external actuality too, and other persons, because imagination is the deputy of thought. Imagination is the deputy of feeling. Imagination is the deputy of will. And the imagination is really the organ of possibility, or the organ of entertaining possibility. The analogy we used last time, and it fits here again, is the kind of thing, what did Carol say today about at noon about work to be done at Holden? Enough to last for, what was it, 300 years? All right, now, I don't know how he arrived at this, but, pardon? All right, and that's fine. I think of even the cathedral at Trondheim. They're still working on that. I had most fun, really, walking around behind the cathedral, talking with and watching the stone cutters, you see. They're still cutting this, and these fellows were born after the thing started. Well, the thing about imagining Holden Village or a cathedral is that this is, first of all, a task of imagination, and the task of imagination is to envision the totality of this thing. Even this little bit that has been thought about out here, this in-between part here, which in a sense is a front yard almost, you say, of Holden Village. And you start asking, I mean, just between these buildings, you start asking yourself, what can be done with this? This is the actuality right out here. This is the necessity, if you please. I mean, this is the given, just that space. And the creek and the bushes and that wonderful monumental double line pole out there with three beautiful transformers on it. And you start thinking about that. And after a while you say, man alive, that's so immense. When you think of these different levels, and one becomes paralyzed, you see. Because how in the world can you get it done? Here people are coming and going. Each week we kind of have a generation here, you know. And how in the world can one generation do the work of a century? So finally you say, oh, well, let's go and play pool, you see, because it's too big. Well, this is what he's getting at with regard to possibilities. Despair is due to the lack of necessity. He emphasizes that in the becoming of the person, imagination plays this role of envisioning that which this given is to become or ought to become. And one can run wild, he maintains, in possibility. The self becomes an abstract possibility which tries itself out with floundering in the possible, but does not budge from the spot. Now, some of you who are here will remember that's what we ended on, that becoming must be a becoming at the spot. But imagination takes one out, and this is all to the good. But if this imagining does not include the necessity or the concreteness of the givenness of the person, whatever he is, in all his oddities, in all his generic qualities, in all his talents, all his deficiencies. Well, you must remember this. How many of you didn't sit in church or sit in class in school and dream, you know? And you're way out there. What was your last name? It wasn't Lundholm then. Maybe you're dreaming about that. But you didn't even know the Lundholm at that time, did you? But here is this little Swedish princess way off in that fine castle in Värmland, you know, or something like this. Young boys do this. They dream about being 6'8", the little runt, you know, 6'8", and putting in baskets that nobody can stop, you see. And but it's a wonderful thing, you see, way out there while it lasts. And one dreams of this. Those of you who have read Peer Gynt know that one of the things Ibsen had in mind with regard to the Norwegians was this romantic dreaming. So you get Peer Gynt there, you know, and he's dreaming about Prince Peer Gynt on the horses and all this. Here he's a penniless liar. I mean, he makes up everything, you see. Even when he talks, he doesn't just dream privately, but his thing starts out, you know. He tells his mother, "What? Where have you been?" "Oh, I've been riding a buck, you know, great big 16-point buck, you know, leaping across the mountains." He lives in this kind of world. And so the actual Peer Gynt is unrelated, you see, to this envisioned Peer Gynt. Now, Anticlimacus, the pseudonym, the pseudonymous writer, claims that this is despair, that this penchant for daydreaming that does not make the circular movement back to the spot where one is really in despair over himself. So that one, this world of imagination in which one plays or becomes this which one dreams of being, becomes a most warming and effervescent substitute, but it is unlinked to the actuality. That's why he says here, the self becomes an abstract possibility which tries itself out with floundering in the possible, the realm of the possible, but does not budge from the spot or get to any spot, for precisely the necessary is the spot. That is the spot in which one exists. To become oneself is precisely a movement at the spot. To become is a movement from the spot, but to become oneself is a movement at the spot. Possibility then appears to the self ever greater and greater, More and more things become possible because nothing becomes actual. At last, it is as if everything were possible. But this is precisely when the abyss has swallowed the self. Now, there are some discussions here, very penetrating, compact discussions of the categories of possibility, actuality, necessity. We won't get into those.
Howard?
Yes?
You asked yesterday for illustrations.
Yeah.
If nobody had any. I realized that we did the same thing in a housing program in D.C., and I didn't know we were doing the philosophical part.
Yeah.
We have about 100,000 people in inadequate housing within the District of Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
We started a program called Home Buyers, and I remember the first conversation, we said no vision is big enough unless it envisions everyone in the District of Columbia in a decent house.
All right.
The vision has nothing but frustration unless we move the first family into a house. So we picked one. And we moved them that next fall. Now we've done 26. But I remember that your vision has to be big enough, but you have to start and take one family, and buy one house, and get the truck, and get the furniture.
Very good.
We did the same kind of thing.
This illustrates what he calls this dialectical movement. The term dialectical simply comes from dialogue. I mean, there's a back and forth movement. And the vision of including everybody is part of that dialectical movement. But you've touched the point. The despair would be the paralysis, really. The thing is so big. Everybody, imagine that, you know, it's fantastic. And remember, the word fantastic comes from fantasy, imagination. But you came back to the spot, didn't you? And there was movement at the spot, on the spot, and in a sense, beyond the spot, or from the spot, because of the vision, but also because the vision came back. Now, that's very good. You see, here we have an analogy in terms of, call it kind of the large business, whereas what this writer is concerned about is the small world, this microcosm. And there is a parallel structure here.
One of the advantages of a Christian community or of a congregation with a variety of gifts is some people tend to stay on the visions and other people tend to have the gift of being very practical. So your entity, a community of people, tends to have the balance of some dreamers and planners and others who are very practical to complement one another. But, you know, each one has to have some of that, but you tend to have some doers and some dreamers.
Just so one thing doesn't happen. Just so the one group doesn't scorn the other.
Right.
If the one scorns the other, then you simply have despair at both ends.
Right.
The two kinds of despair here that are spoken of, that is, possibilities despair, which is lack of necessity, and the second, necessities despair, which is due to the lack of possibility. But it's that dialectical enchainment of the two. Before we move to the second, let me just read this little thing. The despair that we're talking about here, due to the lack of necessity, he says, is connected with this. What really is lacking is the power to obey, to submit to the necessary in oneself, to what may be called one's limit. Therefore, the misfortune does not consist in the fact that such a self did not amount to very much in the world. No, the misfortune is that the man did not become aware of himself, aware that the self, that is the empirical self, the present self, which one is a perfectly definite something, and therefore it is the necessary. On the contrary, he lost himself owing to the fact that this self was seen fantastically, imaginatively, reflected in the possible. And the thing about possibility is that in the realm of possibility, everything is possible. Whereas we are these limited, finite beings who are to become selves. Well, let's turn to this next one, which might possibly come first. The despair of necessity is due to the lack of possibility. here we could introduce a word. Is there chalk there?
We don't need it. It was liberated.
Liberated. All right. Let's just take. You can entertain this one word. I think in intellectual imagination, it is the word ecstasy. Good. And the Latin of this is obviously what?
Ecstasis.
Obviously.
Ecstasis.
All right. Which is?
Just a wild guess.
Outstanding.
The infinitive is ex stare. Sto stare, stare status. So it's ecstasy means to stand outside. Actually, to stand outside oneself. This is what ecstasy is. What was that song you used to sing from your exotic childhood? Something about dancing in one's bones?
"Tain't no sin to take off your skin and dance around in your bones."
Yeah, or something like that. Well, that's ecstasy, you see. It means to get out of your skin and to dance in your bones. This is the role of imagination in the becoming of the self. And so if we look backwards now, before we go ahead, to dance in your bones without your skin is hardly to be even a good corpse, you know. You ought to have flesh and bones. There's something of being beyond oneself. Now, when it comes to this, the despair of necessity or necessity's despair is due to the lack of possibility. It is that one does not stand outside in any sense, imaginatively, you see. He does not stand beyond himself. He cannot envision the realm of becoming, because possibility is a vision of becoming. And without this imaginative possibility or this kind of ecstasy, there is also despair. This is at the other end. He uses some good little figures here. If one will compare the tendency to run wild in possibility, that's this first form, with the efforts of a child to enunciate words, the lack of possibility is like being dumb. I can't remember my childhood at that age. Can you, is there anyone closer to second childhood here who could tell us about it? But as I gather this, he's thinking of the child's trying to imitate words and making a lot of sounds that don't make words, you see. The child has heard words and makes sounds, but they have no order. They do not have what you could call the necessity of spelling, you know, that kind of order. They do not have the necessity of grammatical relationship. If there were any words at all, a child may just say words by themselves, so they lack necessity. Or then he goes on, he says, uses another figure. Necessity is like a sequence of consonants only. Have you ever tried to pronounce some of these Slavic names that have hardly a vowel? What do you have to do? You have to imagine them, you put them in, you see. He says, uses another figure. Necessity is like a sequence of consonants only. Have you ever tried to pronounce some of these Slavic names that have hardly a vowel? What do you have to do? You have to imagine them. You put them in, you see. But leave out the vowels. Now, who knows Hebrew here? What is this about Hebrew? Tell us. I mean, this whole matter of vowels.
Hebrew has or had no vowels, and you put some vowel points, but the text itself is all consonants.
All consonants, but in saying these consonants, one puts in vowels, doesn't he? I mean, orally. You can't really say them.
Now they're written in.
But in writing, then they, for the heretics, you could say, the vowels are put in with dots underneath. What he's saying here is that to lack either vowels or consonants, you see, means that you don't have words. Well, this is just a metaphor. When this is lacking, when a human being is brought to the pass that it lacks possibility, it is in despair. And every instant it lacks possibility, it is in despair. Now, I said earlier that one might first thought imagine that the first kind of despair, that is a lack of necessity, may be the kind that might be found more often among young people, you see. I mean, who are dreaming. The whole world, I mean, they have about a 360-degree world of possibility. And that this other is the kind of despair that characterizes older people. That, well, what is there, you know? I'm stuck. Stuck in jobs, stuck in a marriage, stuck in friendship, stuck in Sleepy Eye, Minnesota. You know, you're stuck in all of these things. And what in the world can you do? And then your body starts to decay, your teeth go, and you, I mean, your feet go, and your innards go, one is really squeezed in. And one is very much aware of the necessities, that one is caught in these givens, which he can't undo, he can't get rid of them. I suppose maybe one of the things the older people ought to remember, I'm not so sure that young people are quite as different as people say they are now. I don't think they are, but if there is a difference, I suspect one difference is that there's far more despair among young people now than one might have found earlier. The sense of being in the grip of various necessities, structural necessities, the lack of possibility. These take many forms. May be more the case now. One commonly thinks that there is a certain age which is especially rich in hope. And remember, again, to go back to a little word study, despair is related to spero, I mean, to hope, or sperare, to hope, and despair means the absence of hope, which means then the absence of possibility. One commonly thinks there is a certain age which is especially rich in hope, or one talks about being or having been at a certain period or a particular moment in one's life so rich in hope, in possibility. Now it's gone down the drain. All this is merely human talk, he says, however, which never reaches the truth. All this hoping and all this despairing is yet not true hope and the true despair. Here he moves to something a little faster than I would expect him to, which some of you people kept pressing for before with your seven-league boots. He says here, the decisive thing is that, I'm going to skip that actually. I don't like to criticize a genius writer, but let's carry skip that and go to this matter. The forms of this kind of despair, again, he says the lack of possibility again has forms or roots. One root is a determinism, and that again he splits up into a determinism and a fatalism. I don't know whether you people remember much of your college courses or even your high school stuff. We've all had some natural science and so on. The philosophy of the natural and the social sciences has been and is, no matter what qualifications come in, is basically a determinism. And you've grown up in this, and your children have grown up in it. This gets back to a very tough problem. If knowledge is to be predictive, there must be this presupposition of a deterministic order of things. I know some sociologists who agonize over this. They say, if we cannot presuppose a deterministic order that is given certain things, this is the consequence. The kind of thing that a chemist expects, you see. Put certain things together and you don't expect a rabbit, you expect a gas, you see. Or you expect some amalgam or something like this. And in the social sciences, they agonize over this. I've talked with them and read things. If we don't presuppose this, how can we have a science, you see? And they take physics, in fact, Newtonian physics, as their model, I mean, their ideal. And we get this. Now, very often this is not made explicit. But this is what he's talking about, this matter of, it's a metaphysical determinism. And he maintains here, personality is a synthesis of possibility and necessity. But if there is only necessity, you see, necessity is determined, or is a determined order. Then he says, this is comparable to breathing in only one direction. If you're going to exhale all your life, you see, you can't do that very long. Or you can't inhale only very long, can you? He says, the dialectic is like inspiration, you know, and expiration. That is the whole business of an in and out. And if there is necessity only, the human self is suffocated. But then he also touches here on another form of necessity. I don't know whether you would make this distinction. Fatalism. Some people think of fatalism as being the same as a determinism, but this writer, at least, is taking the concept of fatalism, I think, from Greek tragedy, for example. Fatalism means that the end is set. If you know, say, Oedipus Rex, think of all the things that Oedipus did, you know. Here this prophecy had been given that he would kill his father and marry his mother. And die a horrible death. He did everything possible, you see. His parents, in fact, did everything possible. They gave him to a shepherd and told the shepherd to expose him on the hillside, you know. So he'd die, but he didn't. So you get Oedipus doing all kinds of things in freedom, you would say, but that the end is set so that one cannot escape. So it's still a determinism with a certain future character to it. But this isn't the worst kind or the most common kind of necessity. The most common kind of necessity is what he calls trivialization. Let me read this. In the case of philistinism or triviality, which always lacks possibility, the situation is somewhat different. Philistinism or trivialization is spiritlessness, in the literal sense of the word. Yeah?
Can't you explain what philistinism is?
Well, this is the way it's translated. The Danish is spitsborgerlighed. It might be translated as the bourgeois mentality, rather than philistinism. It's a narrowness of mind. It's a narrowness of outlook. It's a pettiness. That's what I mean by trivializing. Everything is really small. And one lives in this world of smallness, of pettiness. We could borrow something from another portion here. The soul, the psychosomatic, you could say, the soul bodily synthesis in every man is planned with a view of being spirit. Such is the building. But the man prefers to dwell in the cellar. That is, in the determinants of immediacy or sensuousness, the immediately given, the realm of immediate inclination. And not only does he prefer to dwell in the cellar, no, he loves it to such a degree that he becomes furious if anyone would propose to him to occupy the first floor or the second floor or the penthouse, which stands empty and at his disposition. For after all, he is dwelling in his own house. No, he says, then he goes on, he speaks of a philosopher, but everybody's a philosopher in this sense. A thinker erects an immense building, a system which embraces the whole of existence and world history. And if we contemplate his life, we discover to our astonishment this terrible and ludicrous fact, that he himself personally does not live in this immense high vaulted palace, but in a barn alongside, or in a dog kennel, or at most in the gatehouse, or you say the doghouse, a shanty alongside. This is the same as the Philistinism, which the Philistine or the bourgeois mentality is the one who likes to say again and again, facts are facts, aren't they? And of course, you can't very well argue with that kind of logic, except I'd also say stones are stones, you know. And wheelbarrows are wheelbarrows, and glasses are glasses. It's a tautology, so one isn't getting anywhere. So when these people say facts are facts, and think they're saying something very profound, and you're supposed to bow down in silence before that, well, I'd do that before any tautology, except I do want to ask the question, so what? A thing is what it is. That's a good, it's a principle of identity and logic, and that's the end of the matter. But when one says that, facts are facts, you know, here you get your two groups now that you're talking about in whatever this group is doing. They're the status quo ones, you see. Think of our discussion of last night. I was a little surprised there wasn't any good status quo man last night. I think one can argue for the status quo. You know, one can say something for it. It hurts to change. And who wants to be hurt? You see, you can say something for it. Well, the facts is facts man is a status quo man. And this is why it becomes a trivialization. That is, it denies possibility, you see. Things are what they are, and this is all they can be. Well, does anyone want to say anything about this? Forms of despair viewed from the standpoint of possibility, without a sense of one's concreteness, without a sense of one's limits. That is the fact of me right now. But the other, you see, it's just turned around. The possibility is denied as being fantastic, as being moonshine, as being dreaming. It means being an idealist. This is one of the worst things that some older people can say to young people, you know. You're romantic. You're an idealist. You don't know what the world is. Facts are facts. And elsewhere, Johannes Climacus writes about one of the great things about young people, about youth, is that one does dream. He writes poetry. He may not write it, but poetizing is imagining, you see. It's a reconstruction of the world according to one's heart's desire. It may be a fierce world, it may be a wonderful, enticing world, but it is a construction in the realm of the imagination. He says a sad thing about older people is that they lose the poetry of youth and don't find the concreteness of the ethical religious, but simply find the world of mediocrity and low probability. And that's a necessity, you see, without possibility. And this, he maintains, is despair. Even though one becomes Caesar, or even though one becomes this or that, it is despair.
Hi, when you were speaking of the psychologists, don't you think that one of their major problems is that they are trying to call it a science when it is not a science?
Well, but
Yes, but this is the ideal. You see, what are you going to do then? This is tough. You see, if one gives up, this is the story, I think, of American behaviorism and the quasi-behaviorism of Anglo-Saxon psychology. This is a hard thing, I mean, to give up the conception of a science. Now, Conant, writing on Understanding Science, says, why don't these people give it up, you see? Why don't the sociologists give it up? Political scientists. Now, there's a great battle among political scientists, for example. The counters and the theorists, you see. One is really political philosophy, that's what it is. And the others are the counters. You see, they want to count deal with relationships. This quantification, this is the model of physics. So the counters taunt the theorists by saying, you've given up the very ideal of the science.
I was thinking that you can say about the same thing in psychological terms that Kierkegaard seems to be saying here, and it sounds trivial, it sounds limited. But the way he says it here, it has a possibility ring to it. It's more poetical and more philosophical.
Well, this is...
less trivial.
Were you here the first day? In the title page of this book, the subtitle is A Christian Psychological Exposition for Upbuilding and Awakening. And I mentioned then that perhaps given Anglo-Saxon psychology, which has arisen since that time, and given the English language for readers within this Anglo-Saxon world, or Anglo-American world, perhaps that word can't even be used. For this reason, that this is essentially a philosophical anthropology. This is a conception of man and a pointing to the structure of possibilities. The word possibility is right. If one has, in terms of a psychological system, the ideal of predictive knowledge, you see, then the status of possibility is highly dubious. Unless one does, as the great father of American behaviorism, John B. Watson, said in one of his lectures in print, now that we know that every individual human being is totally a product of the given of his physique, chemique, and the stimuli upon him, the influences, comma, or dash, now let us remake man. You see, here you have this strange sleight of hand, where you have a complete determinism, but you and I mean, we few here, who are on the inside, we understand that everything is determined, and now let us manipulate, you see. The Baconian concept of knowledge is power put in political terms becomes social engineering, basically. But we few know, and somehow we're not in it, you see. We're like the birthday child, you see. Do you do that at your house, the birthday child? Cuts his own piece of cake, you know, first and as big as he wants it. We're like the birthday child then, you see, or John Watson is. And we cut out our piece of cake from this determined cake, you see, and somehow slide out of it. And we're not determined, you see. Here we can do what he's talking about. We can imagine possibilities for all other men, you see, and manipulate them. Now, Kierkegaard is saying, this is why I say one of the few presuppositions here is that of genuine human freedom. But that means your freedom, not my freedom to manipulate you. We can affect each other. But ultimately, here you have, you see, such a deep respect for the genuine human centers, the multiplicity of points of initiative, that I cannot be your point of initiative. As he says elsewhere, for example, in Johannes Climacus, he's thinking in terms of the hero, someone one admires, that person is for me a possibility, you see. What I admire in him is a possibility for me, ethically, you see. It's a direction of my possible becoming. This is a structure of human possibilities with limits. He doesn't say then we have the despair of no necessity, you see, if we ignore that. Well, let's just end. There are so many things going, we don't want to take time into the other hour. Let me just suggest for your reflection, and maybe to entice you to get this and read it, because this is a great book, and I, without blushing or anything or hesitation, I recommend it. There are college students for whom this is 80% of their college education, this book. I mean, when they think back evaluatively, just take the headings here. Despair viewed under the aspect of consciousness. See, before it was from the standpoint of finitude, infinitude, possibility, necessity. He maintains that we touched on this last time, we jumped ahead actually, that despair is universal. It's part of being human. Despair, however, may be, and in most cases is, unconscious. And there's also conscious despair. Conscious despair, he maintains, is more miserable, but there's an advantage to conscious despair, because unconscious despair is, in a sense, farther from healing than conscious despair. And he uses the analogy of physical illness. It's better to know you have it than not to know it. Then the next within that, he speaks of the despair of weakness, the most common conscious despair is the despair over something. That is the whole problem of failure that was discussed in another group. The despair of not attaining that which one had envisioned, you see, as a possibility for himself. And this has a whole range. You can fill in 100 examples yourself. The despair of parents over their children, the despair of a husband over a wife, the wife over a husband, with regard to a job. He calls this the despair of weakness. But the essential character of this despair of weakness is that it is really a despair over oneself, you see. And he maintains that even if one had become Caesar, or gotten the job, or kept the job, or gotten the girl, that there is essential despair, nevertheless, you see. It doesn't show, maybe, but he maintains that these externals which one despairs over are really occasions for the revelation or manifestation of despair over oneself, because despair is essentially, in one of the radical forms, in despair not to will to be oneself. One wants to be something else. Not simply the ideal, but one... Well, finally, the question of self-hate comes in. And I was hoping that would have come up in some other context here. Because Kierkegaard would say that self-hate is despair, you see. And proper self-love... There is such a thing as proper self-love. The ethical consciousness, the religious consciousness, is proper self-love. How does one love himself properly? And to love himself properly is to engage in this life of striving, which is to become an authentic self. Not self-hate, not self-annihilation, This is despair. This is a kind of self-love. This is the deepest selfishness, actually. Because the deepest despair, which wants to get rid of oneself, he has some portions here on Greek philosophy and Greek literature, kind of a drawing off from them. And he touches finally on the pagan view of suicide. Suicide is radical despair, which wants to get rid of oneself. But he says it is the highest presumption, you see. It is the highest selfishness, the highest egocentricity, because it means to play God with the given that one is in this synthesis. I was a little surprised in that discussion that he didn't put in parentheses anyway something about Socrates, because there's no one among the Greeks that he thought more of and learned more from than Socrates. Remember Socrates, when asked about this in the Phaedo, Plato, Socrates there, about suicide, said, "Man, a man does not have the right to commit suicide.